Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter, joined by Jacob Kanzler, Mike Malott, Jack Spencer, and Angela Vasquez Giroux. Angela, did I say it right?
You got so close. Vasquez Giroux.
What did I say?
You said Vasquez? I don't know. You said it like a Michigander. It's fine.
How long have we known each other?
Since 2007. My first day working with you was the day the budget caused the government to shut down on a Friday night.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty good. And I still can't get Vasquez Giroux right.
No. Probably once you do, I'll change it.
Again. Just throw me off. I always got Whitrock right.
That was easier, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So last we knew, you were over being the press secretary for Jim Ananick. And since then, you're just what?
I've been working on a project to encourage comprehensive revenue reform in the state of Michigan.
Okay.
So you know I've always been a closet budget and tax nerd, and that's what I've been working on since then.
And being a general troublemaker.
Yeah, that's probably what you see more.
Well, thanks for joining us here on the podcast here. All right, campaign finance reports, guys. I wanted to get kind of the headline from you from the entire day. Jacob, I'm going to start with you. What was the biggest thing that you walked away with from looking at all those reports mindlessly for hours?
A couple of things. You put me in charge of statewide candidates and ballot question committees. So on the statewide candidates in the gubernatorial race, we're continuing to see a ton of money. I mean, Bill Schuette starting out with plenty of money. I mean, that's probably not a surprise. He joined several other million-dollar candidates. One of those is not Patrick Colbeck, who is one of the few declared gubernatorial candidates.
Yeah, that's not looking real good right now, is it?
No, but he had a good response in his comment and talking about not wanting to buy a Super Bowl ad. So we'll give him that. And then on the ballot question committees, a lot of familiar stories there. What's interesting is that there's actual money behind the minimum wage ballot proposal as well as the paid sick time. And so normally those have tried to get off the ground with just volunteer efforts. And it looks like we're seeing money that would actually pay for signatures this time around.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised with that, too. Mike, what was your top line?
Betty Cook Scott caught up with her paperwork.
That was something else, wasn't it? And it looks like there was more than we thought, too. She just didn't write those four contributions that the Secretary of State flagged for, either. That's not going to get her out of the frying pan, though, it looks like.
No, she still signed an affidavit that appears not to have been true. So she's got to face that. Whether or not it softens the response of the Attorney General is a question. Now she's caught up on her paperwork, so maybe it's not as serious.
Well, we'll find out. That's going to be that would be a serious problem if you're going to run for state senate. You have the Attorney General with a felony charge against you. I'm going to just guess that. Jack, what was your headline?
More money behind the minimum wage increase.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the one that always amazes me because I don't know why the Democrats don't do it every single year.
I think they've kind of gotten the message now.
I mean, they automatically get an increase every time. Problem is the opponents on this, I think you could have polling that showed that they had a 70% chance of actually maybe winning it on a ballot and a 30% possibility that they might lose it would be enough to make them talk the legislature into another increase.
Angela, what was yours?
Mine is definitely Abdul Al-Sayed still not paying his staff health care. Campaign finance report shows he spent something like $15,000 on food, but still no health care for his staff.
Well, now he's just putting it into the base increase.
Well, right,
Angela.
Think about that. If you're a campaign staffer and you're making, what, $36,000 or $60,000 a year, if you're lucky, that comes to you monthly. Their tax is taken out of it, and then you're going to pay health care on that. After-tax wages to pay for health care seems like quite an extreme ask for, you know, kids who probably aren't on their parents' health care anymore either.
So to play devil's advocate, people have done this before. Why is this a big deal for Abdul?
Well, if he's calling for comprehensive health care for everyone in the state of Michigan, but he can't see fit to extend that to his own staff, I feel like that's problematic. And it's a basic Democratic value, right? We believe in health care. We believe in taking care of employees. We believe in fair wages. This is all part and parcel of that.
You know, Jacob, something that struck me was that some of these ballot committees, they actually look like they're serious. Maybe I'm being a little naive, but I guess we've seen in the past things like paid sick time not really get off the ground because there didn't seem to be a lot of funding behind it. Marijuana, yeah, okay, whatever. I mean, we've seen that. There seems to be money behind these things.
Yeah, I mean, just go down the list. I mean, on the marijuana, you really had like a lot of like the big players came in. You had the Marijuana Policy Project come in. They've done this before. They've won in states. They did that. I mean, when anytime you recruit Truscott Rossman, it seems like you have some money to throw around for PR-wise. So they definitely got more, I don't know, mainstream. The issue got more mainstream. They got all their ducks in a row. And then on the paid sick time and minimum wage, I mean, they found money in various places. It's not exactly clear who is funding them or what these funds or other you know, out-of-state things are doing, but they come to the table with money, and so it's you kind of need to sit up and take them seriously and see where they go here.
Where are the Democrats getting all this money, Angela? All of a sudden, you guys are paying stuff that could actually do well on the ballot. You guys might actually get some stuff on the ballot. It looks good.
I think probably in the past few years, funders have been keeping their powder a little dry, wondering when would be the best time. I think when you don't have a lot of money, you have to be more strategic, right? So now the Democrats are more like the Boise State of Michigan politics. So you really do have to be more deliberate, right? And I think we've seen in the last probably 6 years or so, at least especially since the, what was the name of the campaign that was anti-right to work? Protect our jobs, right? I think we learned a lesson there that we need to make sure that if we put something on the ballot, we're going to win. If we know we're going to win, then the funders will come to the table.
Mike, I gave you the caucus committees, and gosh, the House Republicans, and we're going to have Sam Singh here a little later talking about how the Dems did, which was pretty good, but boy, the House Republicans are raising a lot of money and they have no debt.
Got a nice, healthy war chest, but I'm not sure that was a surprise.
I think the fact that they're already at $1.5 million this early in the campaign cycle, though, is unprecedented, and if you're a Republican, I think that's a good sign. You're probably going to need as much money as you need going into the first off term of a Republican president.
And, I would totally agree with that. Remember, we're a year and a half out.
Year out. Why wouldn't you panic right now if you're a Democrat, Angela, seeing what the House Republicans put in?
I think it's not cause for alarm, but it's definitely they're not going to just accept the fact that it could be a wave year for Democrats, right? Sure, we expect that we'll have a little help in terms of Trump being the president, but we're still going to have to work as hard as we would any other year, and that includes raising more money.
Jack, is Patrick Kolbeck and his $13,000 in his campaign mean that he's dead meat?
Yeah, he must have had some kind of plan somewhere down the line. Otherwise, either that or he just likes traveling around Michigan and saying, I'm a candidate. Because there was never going to be any chance for him unless he got money from somewhere. And I always assumed there was some threshold he'd have to hit or something like that that he thought would open the gates for him. So it's kind of a confirmation of what I think we knew all along, that this was something where he's making an effort, you know, to build up some kind of a support or some kind of basis for going to somebody or getting money from somebody to go on with. But yeah, that's pretty slim pickings.
$13,000, that isn't a lot of money to, if you're running a statewide campaign. You're not going to get any TV ads with that.
You're not going to get a rocket ship off the ground, yeah. You're not going to get to space with that.
You know, Angela, something that we noticed here this past week, you're moving off the campaign finance reports. Democrats behind the scenes are talking about another candidate for attorney general. Patrick Miles and Dana Nessel isn't good enough. What are you hearing on the rumor mill on this?
I think there's some concern about Pat Miles being a little squishy on some issues that are really important to Democrats. And there's a concern probably I like Dana Nessel quite a bit as a candidate and as a person. I'm a fan of her work, clearly, but sounds like some people are backing Eric Smith and they think that if he gets in, he'll win. And I think that's probably a consideration a lot of the big party backers are considering is who can win, right? It's not enough to just have candidates on a slate and hope that folks vote essentially straight ticket anymore.
And you know what? This was really surprising to me because I watched both Patrick Miles and Dana Nessel, and off the record, I thought they both did really well. Now, I know that Patrick Miles stumbled around on the medical marijuana issue, but on the other hand, I mean, a Republican isn't going to be pro-pot either. You know what I mean? So, in fact, it would probably be harder on marijuana than Patrick Miles would be, right? So, I don't know. I guess I didn't really see that as a big stumbling block, but I guess in the progressive community, it's a big deal.
I think there's some push among progressives and, you know, Dems who've always been progressive to put up candidates who are not, who don't play so much to the middle, right? Like, if you figure you might not win Macomb County if you're Dana Nessel. You might win, and you probably could win, Macomb County if you're Eric Smith, right? If you look at his numbers from the 16 election, he outperformed Hillary Clinton. That's important. He won with a vote that, you know, we don't have another candidate who could do that, and that's important. What he could do possibly on this, you know, in encouraging certain voters there to perform differently than they did in 2016 is really important.
Jack, I want to get your outside perspective on this. So do you think it matters much if the Democrats put up Patrick Miles, Dana Nessel, Steve Beda, or let's say Eric Smith, or, I don't know, the Pillsbury Doughboy against the Republican in a Trump year? How big of an impact does that make?
Well, I think you want to be very careful how you select your candidates. Play to the middle, I think to some extent you've got to be able to play to the middle. I mean, we can't forget Michigan went red for the first time in forever last time. And how does that play this next year in 2018? Nobody knows. There's all kinds of dynamics out there in both parties in terms of who's going to turn out, who's not going to turn out. I always am curious, though, on the Democratic side, how much does just the bigger picture of how the entire ticket gels play into it? I mean, we know we've got at least Jocelyn Benson on there. So we've got the woman on the ticket and maybe Gretchen Whitmer, too. But there's sort of this construction part that goes on the Democratic side of, you know, of how you want the overall ticket to work. And I think until they get a good view of and have a good idea what the entire ticket looks like, I think there's always going to be some second guessing on would this part be better than this other part.
Well, that's the question I have, too. Why can't the Democrats do what the Republicans do, just kind of throw them out there and just kind of see what happens? I kind of like that. I like seeing the results come in, and I don't know, maybe that's just the Christmas surprise with elections for me, but the Democrats don't like to see that.
I think there's a mood, right, in Democratic politics right now. We saw, obviously, Michigan went red, and a big part of that was because there were definitely some progressives and Dems who decided they wanted a candidate who wasn't on the ballot. I think we need to do a better job of making sure that everyone feels like they have a say in who's on the ticket. And, you know, maybe there will be coming up a little more balance between what the voters would like to see and what the party leaders would like to see.
All I know is that the most fun Democratic convention I was at was in 2010 when we had Bernstein versus David Layton, and it came down to the 15th congressional district before we knew who was going to win that one. David Layton won, but I thought both candidates did well in that atmosphere. And looking at Dana Nessel versus Patrick Miles, and if another candidate gets in, fine. But I think it made both candidates very sharp. And as far as the Democrats are concerned, I would think that Trump would have much more of an impact on the attorney general's race than anything that you could do as far as like a campaign, right? I mean, Patrick Miles or Dana Nessel, unless either of them have a complete meltdown, which I just don't see, right? I mean, they're both quality candidates. I guess the point I'm making is, as far as quality goes, I don't think you need to let the perfect get in the way of the very good.
Right.
I guess that's my point.
Well, I think your point about the importance of this race, especially in a Trump presidency, you know, right now we have Attorney General Bill Schuette, who uses his office as a way to enact the agenda of, you know, people who don't represent the majority of Michiganders, and that's problematic. He's weighing in on behalf of, you know, companies who would like to dictate what kind of birth control I have access to. I think it's really important, especially for Democrats and progressives and working families and, you know, people who like having options, to look at the attorney general's race and think, you know, who of these candidates do you think is going to be the backstop for you, right? If everything goes poorly and we win just the AG's race, there's at least one person who can help buffer these really problematic policies from impacting us.
The other thing too, Jack, don't forget, just because you win the election doesn't mean that you got yourself a good candidate. I'm thinking of the Republicans putting up, what's her name there in Macomb County. Now they got a clerk there that they can't wait to get rid of. I mean, there's something to be said for getting somebody in office who actually wants to be there, right? And I also go back to 2006, and I was on my phone here trying to remember, God, who was that they put up there because they didn't want Scott Bowen, who actually wanted to be Attorney General?
Well,
I couldn't remember his name. Do you remember his name? Guy from Detroit. He had one hand. Okay, you keep thinking, I'll find it. But anyway, you see where I'm going with this.
Well, yeah, I mean,
You got to want the position.
You got to want the position, but I don't know if you ever get where, gee, I'm sorry, we won. I'm not sure that ever comes about. But my whole problem with 218, and I think it's a general problem we all have as reporters, and particularly as political prognosticators, is you had a guy win the presidency in 2016 with a 37% favorability. And you had a guy who was outspent, and you had all these things where all the gauges were wrong. It's kind of like you go on your back porch, and you feel a chill and everything, and you look at your thermometer, and it says 72 degrees. And are you going to believe it next time? That's the problem. It's probably going to be right from then on. It probably was just one malfunction in 2016. But my problem is, how do we know which gauges to trust anymore? And I think it's really difficult to have confidence in the kinds of things we used to have confidence in.
Everything's been kind of thrown all off whack, and maybe that's to your point, Angela. We just can't be too careful. We can't take anything for granted.
Well, I think that's also important to remember that there are other ways to find out how people feel about an issue besides calling them or convening a focus group. This is probably one place where we fell down as a party and as a movement is not, you know, is trusting too much that polling worked the same when, like Jack said, like the chill in the air, everything was clearly apparent that there was a mood, that there was something that was about to happen. And I think that there are a lot of innovative companies right now that are looking at ways to ground truth things like polling and see, you know, if
ground truth?
Yeah, ground truth.
Like, ooh, I've never heard this word before.
Oh, I learned that word from one of my favorite bosses of all time, David Holtz, by the way.
Oh, nice.
I think, you know, there's a market and probably a lot of value in taking the polling that we see and testing it out on something like, you know, some digital ads or something. I think people are onto the fact that polls are asking them questions and will be amplified back to them until they behave differently. That's a real problem, and that's probably not going to change, so we need to change our testing methods instead.
Amos Williams is the name I was trying to think of. 2006, Amos Williams. And one other thing I just want to point out, 2010, which I think we'd all agree was a very bad Democratic year, just to talk about what kind of an impact a wave election could have, I think we would agree that Joslyn Benson was a very good Secretary of State candidate. I think we'd agree with that. And Virge Bonaro was running a campaign where Snyder was starting at the 50-yard line and Virge was starting at the end zone, and they were running to the other end zone, right? So, I mean, that not so good. So Joslyn Benson got 45% of the vote, and Virge got 40% of the vote. So, I mean, there's a little bit there, but in a wave election, you know, basically you could run Big Bird as Attorney General, and Big Bird would probably win. Or am I going too far out on that?
I think it's a good metaphor, but, you know, the reality is that we can't have Big Bird in office, right?
It'd be pretty fun, though. His press conferences would be great.
Are you that sure about that?
I guess that's true. I was completely wrong about Donald Trump. But I think, you know, there's something to be said that maybe it is just going to be a wave and we could do whatever we wanted and we would win, right? But there's still a responsibility, I think, to the people of Michigan to give them public servants who will serve them. Like the Macomb County clerk, right? Who wants that? I don't want that. You know, I would rather have people in office who have experience, who have a desire to serve people, not a desire to, you know, be Bill Schuette in office and enact their agenda, but a desire to serve the people who voted for them.
Okay, well, with that, we're going to move on to the interview portion here with the House Minority Leader, Sam.
They're all together, Oogie, the Adams family. Their house is a museum where people come to see them. They really are a scream, the Addams Family.
Neat. Sweet. Petite.
Joining us here in MERS World Headquarters is the Minority Leader for the House of Representatives. He is Sam Singh. Thanks for joining us here.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Okay, so you guys are trumpeting an issue that we're not very familiar with here at this table, wage theft. Tell our listeners what this is.
That's right. You know, every day, you know, all across the state and nation, there are a handful of bad actors in the business community that take advantage of their employees. The Economic Policy Institute out of Washington, D.C., estimated close to $500 million have been taken away from workers. And it comes in a variety of ways. It could be people are misclassified as independent contractors when they're actually employees. Could be, you know, a restaurant worker who's not making minimum wage when you calculate all their hours and their tips. Oftentimes you hear stories of companies keeping tips, sometimes even encouraging people to have to pay upfront to get a job when they're on a small-time contract and so forth. So you see a lot of those types of things, and we wanted to begin to address that issue by making sure that there was real penalties for those types of companies that are taking advantage. Right now, a penalty could be as limited as 10% of what they've stolen from that employee. We want that to be 100%. We want to make sure that the fines are at the level that's appropriate. When you look at other states and their enforcement of it from the state, they have so much more resources going towards that. So we want the state of Michigan to increase the resources there. And then we want to make sure those individuals, those workers that are just trying to make ends meet, that they actually are, when they can prove that wages have been stolen from them, that they can actually get money from that company three times the amount that was taken.
Are you talking criminal charges here?
Well, I mean,
is this,
I think,
criminal?
There is probably some groups that have reached that level of criminality, but oftentimes these are done when you have an investigation done by LARA. Oftentimes there will be penalties attached, and right now we don't think those penalties are at a level to deter it. If these reports that are suggesting $500 million of wages are kept from employees, that's something that can't be done in this state. We cannot allow for that to happen. And so that's why we're taking a look at this issue. We'll be talking about it a little later this week about it and introducing those bills. But it is something that's happening all across the country. But we want to make sure that in Michigan that we take a look at what the best states are doing so we can protect those individuals from having their wages, their hard-earned wages, stolen from them.
Can you give us an idea of how rampant of this issue is in Michigan specifically? Like, do you have any stats on like dollars lost by workers?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, $500 million dollars has been estimated by the Economic Policy Institute out of Washington, D.C. I do think when you take a look at this, it often happens in areas where people are independent contractors. Oftentimes, we're seeing this in the building trades where individuals have taken advantage of them. We've heard some situations down here that I know a variety of different prosecutors across the region are beginning to take a look at on whether people were fully given the resources that they were promised. In one instance, there was question that they had to actually pay the subcontractor up front before they could actually get a job. There was a case out in West Michigan with the carpenters. The company owed them $35,000, still hadn't paid them. And so they had to use these types of tools. And so that's how this is coming to our attention, is that this is happening at a larger level than ever before. $500 million is real money to our economy that could be flowing into businesses and helping those families. And so that's why we're taking this very seriously. And I would hope that the administration and the business community would join with us, because nobody wants to see these bad actors out there. They put a bad name to the business community. They take a bad name to construction contractors and so forth. And in the reality, we should be rewarding those that are doing good things and best practices than the ones that are trying to take advantage of people that are trying to make ends meet.
So is this a package of bills that you'll be introducing?
Yeah, and when will we see it?
Well, we're having our press avail later today, and so we will be talking about that. There's at least three bills in that package. We'll be going through those details later today. But that's one of, you know, many areas. You know, we're very concerned that the average worker is not being engaged appropriately in this economy. They don't feel like the economy is working for them. It's one of the reasons why we've taken a look at pharmaceutical pricing here in the state of Michigan. It's one of the reasons why we're really pushing the Republicans in the House and the Senate to take a stand on health care and make sure that they tell Washington, D.C., we want health care. We want to make sure that pre-existing conditions and those types of things that protect these working families are actually kept here. And so we will continue that, you know, throughout our time here, because when people are being taken advantage of and when the economy gets better, we should be helping people, making sure that those resources are getting there. And when we find out that companies are illegally keeping the wages from their employees, there needs to be real action taken by this state. And that's why these bills are going to be discussed later today.
Specifically, what would Tom Leonard have to do to his auto insurance bill in order to get your yes vote?
Well, I've always said, for me and for Democrats and Republicans that have, you know, had concerns with the bill as it was introduced, is that we want to make sure that people who are in those catastrophic accidents are taken care of and protected. You know, I'm very open to having conversations around reform, making sure that we bring down the cost. That is something we've always said all along that we are committed to. But as of right now, what happens in this plan is that you are told you're going to be given some potential discounts by taking a very, very limited policy. And that policy would then require you, if you're in that catastrophic accident, to basically go into bankruptcy so you could then go after Medicaid or Medicare. It doesn't allow you all the tort opportunities that have in other states. And so it's really an area that has, I think, puts the individual at deep risk. And I think there are other ways to bring down the cost in a very effective way. And that's what we've been talking about and we'll continue to talk about through this process.
Is there any evidence at all that shows that Michigan, if you get in an accident or something like that, you get better care here for all of this catastrophic stuff, that we're the only state in the country that does it?
Absolutely. You take a look at brain trauma injury anywhere in the country, and they will tell you that Michigan has the best brain trauma, whether it's rehab, actual surgery, and so forth. The insurance companies will tell you that as well. There's a reason why the military sends some of the hardest hurt people to Michigan and to the facilities here in Michigan because of that piece. You also see that in athletics. When they're hurt in other leagues and other parts of the country, they come to Michigan for that type of care. So absolutely, that care is there. And what we want to make sure is that that care continues, but we can do it at a way to bring down costs. And so, you know, we are committed, if there is fraud in the system, to go after the fraud. We want to reduce the number of lawsuits that are there. What ends up happening now is an insurance company basically says no, and then a hospital or somebody else and the individual has to sue them, and it kind of goes back and forth. And I think we can remove all of those things, which would remove a lot of cost to the system if the insurance companies actually had to pay what was required. And so we're seeing that type of issue rise here, and the insurance companies have, I think, unfortunately taken advantage of people throughout this process, which is why you've seen those lawsuits. You know, the bill that is in front of us allows a great loophole for these insurance companies to go to the insurance commissioner to, quote unquote, get themselves out of any kind of pay reduction that was potentially promised in any press conferences and so forth. So, yeah, there's a lot of concerns. And it's not just Democrats that have the concerns, right? You can talk to a number of Republicans that have concerns as well. And the big thing, you know, once House Fiscal finally did the analysis, is that, hey, there's going to be now $150 million hole into the budget. And, you know, with all the problems that we've been having with the budget, taking out another $150 million is going to be considerable.
So are you a hell no on PIP choice?
Well, I don't think PIP choice is what we should be talking about. I think we should be finding other ways to reduce costs. And I think there
What about a fee schedule?
I've always been open to figuring out the right level of costs around a fee schedule. Okay. I don't think the fee schedule that was introduced in this initial bill is something that can be managed by anybody, really. When you take a look at, you know, Medicare and Medicaid, both as systems have really been about not necessarily fully funding what the true cost of things are and so forth. And so to me, I think there's a lot of openness for dialogue, and I've said to the speaker, including over the weekend, that, you know, if there is a discussion about wanting to bring down true cost and not necessarily taking away people's benefits, that I would be willing to have those conversations, and I'm continue to commit to doing that, because I do think there is a way to do this. When you take a look at 13 bills have been introduced in a bipartisan fashion. There's an additional 4 other Republican bills that were introduced prior to that package. So there's a total of 17 bills sitting in the Insurance Committee that want to talk about auto no fault, and none of them have been given a hearing. None of them have been given the respect when you have only 6 of those 17 done by Democrats. The 11 of them done by Republicans. Why are they not having those hearings? Why are they not looking at all the options that should be in front of us? Listen, we've got over $20 billion into the MCCA that people have invested in and put in. And, you know.
You should crack that open?
Well, no, I think that's what we have to protect, that. Those are people's investments. Those are meant to be there to help people with their long-term injuries during this type of system. And so to me, that should really be the conversation. And what I've not seen is, an opportunity to look at all of the issues that are facing auto no-fault.
The Republicans have said that they want 40% savings on the lowest tier of PIP choice. And for the Fredericks Coalition, CPAN Coalition bills, the highest number that I've heard that savings that can be achieved is about 30%, 20 to 30%. The Republicans are arguing that Democrats represent constituents and communities that need those rate rollbacks the most. How do you respond to that?
I would say, first of all, one of the reasons why urban communities are paying more in insurance is that we've allowed redlining in this state. You can't call it redlining. They'll call it territorial pricing and things like that. But that is what is creating this issue. And so, you can't find me a single person who says that this plan is going to change that discrepancy, that somebody in an urban city like Detroit will be always paying twice as much at a minimum than one of the suburban communities a little further out from where they are. And so this bill doesn't deal with those issues. And so to me, I think that is a big issue. It has not been addressed in these bills. That's a big disappointment. And that's where a lot of my members that are representing those kind of urban communities tell us that that's really where the big issue is. And that's why when you look at that 13-bill package, you do see that we go after a lot of those rating factors that have absolutely nothing to do with somebody's driving. Whether it's credit history, whether it's that they were married, a whole variety of those types of things that have nothing to do with this, where other states have banned those across the country, they still are allowed here in the state of Michigan. And that's, obviously been very troubling. And so, again, that's why you take a look at everything that's in front of the committee. You don't just take a look at one bill. You allow the opportunity for all of these issues to be addressed. Because once you do, I do think that there is a way that could get significant bipartisan support and even my support if that is really looked at. And you take a look at those 17 bills that are in the committee, because I do think they will bring real rate reduction that we can quantify and be able to put into a bill. And that, at the same time, not taking away the rights and benefits that people have had here in the state of Michigan. And what I don't want to do is force these people into bankruptcy just so they can get the health care that they need and the services that they need.
Would there be political repercussions, caucus repercussions, to any House Democrat who votes yes on PIP choice?
Listen, I've always said that Democrats care about people, and this is an issue about people and people who end up being in a catastrophic accident. And so we have always said that we want to make sure that we protect those individuals as we go forward. We will take a look at, any bills that come forward that will actually focus on those individuals. This bill that is in front of us does not do that. And so for me, I have always encouraged both Republicans and Democrats, keep an open mind, because with 17 other bills that are sitting in the insurance committee, there are opportunities here to take down the cost of auto insurance and make sure that it's affordable to all people, because that should be our goal and our mission. It shouldn't be taking out and dusting off a plan that, was looked at 4 years ago and failed, and 6 years ago and failed. We should be looking at how we try to address these types of issues in a way that brings down costs for people but doesn't take their benefits away from them.
That wasn't a no.
As I said, we're always going to be focused on those types of issues. Again, the individual who's in that catastrophic accident, that's the person I care about, and that's the focus that we've had for the 5 years that I've been here, and I know will continue, because that is what we should be talking about, the people that are most impacted by these policies.
Why don't you think that the Republicans are taking those bills up? Do you think they're trying to work on something that they can pass themselves in both chambers?
Well, again, you'd have to talk to them about why they're not taking up those bills. To me, when you have a significant amount of Republicans in your own caucus, 11 of them, asking for those bills to be taken up, you'd have to ask them, why aren't they taking those bills up? When there are opportunities for us to get to cost savings that would have significantly more bipartisan support than you have today or have had in the last few years, why wouldn't you take every opportunity to look at every single type of plan and see what we can move forward? That, to me, is what legislation is about. That's what compromise is about. That's what we should be doing here. And I think, unfortunately, that process hasn't fully vetted itself out.
Sam, I appreciate you taking so much time with us. Last thing I wanted to ask you about, though, was the campaign finance filings from this past week. What struck you in that, and how do you think House Democrats are sitting looking ahead to the 2018 elections?
Well, I think House Democrats are doing really well. If you take a look at the three quarters that we filed in, we've actually beaten all three quarters that we filed in over the last three cycles. So to us, we really feel that there's this momentum growing with the amount of open seats that will be there, because it's a Senate election year as well. A lot of Republican members are not looking at fulfilling their three terms, and so they're leaving early. So that gives us a lot of opportunity. And when you take a look at what's happening nationally with a number of seats that had gone to Trump by 20% or 15%, those seats being flipped now in state chambers, that, you know, there's a great opportunity for us in 2018. And look forward to that.
They've raised a lot of money, though, Republicans have.
Sure, Republicans always raise money, right? They have those types of benefactors, but there's only so much you can do with money in the end, right? It's the end when people really want to see that type of change. We always get outspent by the Republicans, whether it's on a national stage, state stage, local stage, but we do win when those issues that are facing our communities are addressed. And that's why, you know, Democrats, we will only be talking about those economic issues that are facing people in our community. And the fact that the Republicans are not trying to deal with health care as an issue for people. They're not trying to deal with the pharmaceutical prices, that they're not, you know, taking a look at policing the business community. You saw that with the unemployment agency where, you know, those individuals, they're doing things to help them going forward. But those individuals that have been impacted by that, they didn't even make those people whole. You know, the fact that they're walking away from those working families day in and day out, we'll make sure that those working families are aware of that as we go into this election in 2018.
Sam Singh, the House Minority Leader, thanks so much for spending so much time with us. And sorry you couldn't walk down here.
Yeah, it's kind of a drizzly day. And yeah. So hopefully we'll get us a little better weather before we finally get the snow. So yeah.
But on the other hand, Kyle, you'll notice there's no lawnmower going in the background.
Yes, that is positive. And hopefully we won't have to hear one for a while. That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Sam Singh, Sam Hart for bringing him down, Jack, Jacob, and Mike Malott, and of course, Angela Vasquez Drew.
Nailed it.
Yes! Oh my God, I'm so excited. Okay, what are you dressing up as Halloween tomorrow?
Oh God, I always forget what I want to do. I am thinking Jessica Jones.
Whoa, now that would be very exciting. Now, we tried to get Sam to see what the little baby was going to be. And he said, you're going to have to find out on Facebook tomorrow. So the big Remy unveil will be tomorrow.
I can't wait. I hope it's a pumpkin.
Oh, or you know what? I was looking at pictures the other day, and I saw what Finnegan was, because I forgot what he was. That was only 5 years ago. And he was a little cow. A little cow costume. But, you know, this is how you know that insurance isn't going to be run tomorrow. Because could you imagine what Janelle Leonard would say to Tom if he says, yeah, I'm going to do an all-nighter on Halloween, on little Hannah's first Halloween. How do you think that would go?
Hopefully not. I'd like an early night.
We could have Halloween. You know what, Jack, that would be kind of fun. We could do Halloween on the house floor, and all the reps could bring their kids, and we would go from desk to desk, and they'd all have to say trick-or-treat.
I think we've had various versions of Halloween on the house floor in other years. So, regardless of what season it was.
I'm Kyle Mullen. Until next week, take care.